Now you should listen to this, because this concerns you.
This is about a evil genius in love.
Headed for the door. And I wouldn't walk through anymore. And if I never ever woke again. It's almost worth it.
Hello, hello, hello. Welcome to the show, my little podcast friends and neighbors. It's me, Dave Slusher, your podcast buddy. This is the Evil Genius Chronicles. This is show number 221. I'm recording this on March 7th, 2008. And let's just get right to all of the business. This show is Creative Commons licensed, non-commercial attribution. The show is not work safe. The show is not kid safe. This episode is guaranteed not work or kids safe. The music you're listening to is the Gentle Readers. They're at gentlereaders.com. You should buy everything they've ever put out. I'm telling you, everything they've ever put out. And our bandwidth is provided by Cashfly. Bandwidth by Cashfly. That's new, but it's true. Bandwidth by Cashfly. All right, my friends, the last show that I did was very down. And while it was all heartfelt, it was a real downer about my distress and disillusion with the state of our nation. So we're going to kind of go the opposite end of the spectrum because I need to pick myself back up. And I've had this in the can for a long time. And this is we're going to feature my interview with Dr. Philo Drummond of the Church of the Subgenius. He's on the Puzzling Evidence show out of KPFA Berkeley. It airs Friday mornings, 3 to 5 Pacific. You can stream it live on the internet, or you can listen as I do to the podcast. And I've been listening to Puzzling Evidence for a couple of years. Ever since they started podcasting, I've been listening to the other Subgenius Ministries, the Hour of Slack and Bob's Slack Time Funhouse, on and off for like 14, 15 years. So I ain't a newbie to this thing. I am a newbie to having paid my money to the Church of the Subgenius. So what we're going to do is I'm going to play you a song. I'm going to do a little bit, not long, like a minute or 2 minutes of Subgenius preaching, which I've never done before. This is really all for me. And then we'll get right to my interview with Philo Drummond. And I was looking for some music that kind of fit the feel of the show, kind of fit what I was trying to do. And from the album Dead Dog's Eyeball by Kathy McCarty, which is all songs written by Daniel Johnston. This is the one that matches how the rest of the show feels. It's called Like a Monkey in a Zoo.
I'm chained to the wall. I have nothing at all. And my eyes look into the sunset thinking of better things to do. Like a monkey in a zoo. The days go so slow. Like a monkey in a zoo. And it could happen to you. You could be in my place. No, it wasn't always like this. Oh, but I never saw it coming. I'm so alone. But this is my home. Like a monkey in a zoo, throw me a peanut, laugh and make jokes, but I've had enough peanuts and I'm ready to croak, like a monkey. No, it's my fault, but I want out. And when I cry out, nobody seems to understand. Like a monkey in a zoo, you say I'm cute. used to be happy. I can remember those days, but I sold my freedom for free room and board like a monkey.
Kathy McCarty, Like a Monkey in a Zoo, from the album Dead Dog's Eyeball, a tribute to Daniel Johnston. Let's get right to it. And this is not Dave anymore. This is the wrong Reverend Stig Mathers. So a lot of you out there, you might believe in a God. You might believe in more than one God. You may not have heard the word of Bob, and you may not know anything about Bob. But let's put it this way. Once you believe in any magic man in the sky, powerful enough to create the universe, personal enough to give a shit about you, once you believe in one of those, you should believe in all of them. It's just a little matter of detail to get from one to the next one. And once you believe in that, it's real easy to believe in Bob, my friends. The idea of a salesman, a smiling man, a happy man. All he wants to do is make things easy for you. He wants to give you a pass. That's slack, my friends. And that's all that Bob's about, really, is slack. Bob's about making things. Bob's about greasing the wheels of the universe, and you're the grease. So let's put it this way. Let's compare and contrast. You know, I live in the South. I live in the Bible Belt. Everyone's familiar with Jesus. So let's do a little compare and contrast between Jesus and Bob. Jesus is the shepherd. He guards the flock. He tends the flock. Bob, on the other hand, he's a fleecer. Bob holds the shears, and he's responsible for fleecing the entire flock. And then when the wool regrows, he does it again. And Bob will keep doing that, because that's Bob. Jesus forgives your sins. Bob does not forgive your sins. Bob justifies your sins. Bob provides you with an excuse. Bob tells the world it's okay. Bob may have lifted a doctor's pad. Bob may write you a note to work, and he may write you a prescription while he's at it. That, my friends, is Bob. Jesus is the rock. Bob is a face full of gravel. Sorry, I broke myself up. Bob is a face full of gravel. Spit into your face from the tires of an El Camino as it peels out on a dirt road. That, my friends, is Bob. Jesus is the sword and shield. Bob is a straight razor in your boot and an ace up your sleeve. Jesus is the Prince of Peace. Bob is a man of action. Bob gets it done. And praise Bob, that is what you need in a savior. A short-term savior, a short-duration personal savior, that is Bob. And if you want to get salvation, guaranteed salvation, or triple your money back, subgenius.com. Pay them $30 and you've got it made. So you got $30 in, $90 back. Those are good pot odds, my friend. All right, before we do anything, any other nonsense, that was a little rough. That's the first one I've done. They'll get better. Let's go straight to the interview with Philo Drummond from the Puzzling Evidence Show. And I should warn you, the first couple minutes of this interview start out extremely slow. I believe Brother Drummond takes a little time to warm up. He's kind of like the diesel engine of the show. So the first couple, it takes a little while before the clutch engages, but when it does, it really, really engages. As I was editing and listening back, I was busting a gut. So I hope all of you enjoyed it as much as I did. Here we go. Take it away, Philo. All right, tell me a little about your involvement with the founding of the Church of the Subgenius, you and Reverend Stang.
Oh, we're going to talk about the show later, right?
We'll talk about everything, but we'll kind of start at the beginning with the kind of immaculation and let's start off with a rumor. Is it true that the Mormons got their word from the heavens on golden plates? Is it true that the word of Bob came down on Chinette plates with barbecue sauce on them?
No, that's not true.
Oh, okay.
No. The word of Bob was I channeled Bob for quite some time early on. I was Bob's kind of a channeler, you know, one of those guys. And Reverend Stang and I back in those days, I used to, you know, go into that Overman mode quite more frequently. But, so, I guess, are you looking for, like, stuff that has never been said before? Or,
you know,
pretty much most of the dogma, I mean, most of the story of how it started, are you looking for how it started, or?
Well, just,
you know,
for the people who may not be as completely immersed in the history of it as I am, get some of the pinker of my listeners up to speed a little.
Oh, okay. Well, you know, back around 79 or so, I guess, is when there's a lot of detail, actually, you know, if you want to, like, go back all the way to college days and things like that, where I first met Bob. And then I was a friend of his in college. That's how the story goes. And then Reverend Stang and I met a little bit later and realized the connection was a whole lot more planned out by forces other than us, rather than just, you know, a chance connection. And that's when pretty much we got the message of what the goal was, and everything just started happening after that. You know, it's like, it's a whole lot like interesting coincidences that have happened in the past. You know, if it happens once, it's just an event, right? If it happens twice, it's a coincidence. But if it happens three times, it's a conspiracy. See?
There you go.
So after a long, you know, developmental stage, which included a foundation and a PR arm and our own negative anti-entity, you know, everybody has to have an enemy. You know, you're not really valid if you don't have the enemies, right? It's sort of like part of the validation process.
Mm-hmm.
So early on, those types of things were developed and fleshed out. And then it's become the burgeoning cult that it is today, of which you're a member.
I am a paid-up member, so.
And so the pinker elements out there would be more inclined to want to hear something like that. Now, you know, the paid-up people who are the enlightened members might have a different needs, you know. They probably do have different needs. They need more of a story with more meat in it, something that sticks to your bones, you know, when you hear it. More the secret inside stuff.
Now, know? One of the things I like about the church is that pretty much like any TV or radio preacher you ever hear, the church has the same goal. It's just that the subgeniuses aren't bullshitting anyone about it. They want your money. It's very, very simple, plain language.
Well, it's true, but only because in the church of the subgenius, money will buy slack. You can get slack for free, and everybody has original slack. We've all been blessed by it, whether we choose to recognize it or not. But you can buy more slack with money. It's not, it's almost like, it's no secret, really. You know? Money, you can pave a road to permanent slack with dollar bills. And that's really, so it's not really the money, it's the slack, you mm-hmm. see? Don't focus on the money part. You need the money. But it's only a vehicle to get to the ultimate goal, you know. So, is to get back that slack, which the conspiracy has taken away from you.
So
it robbed you, sometimes before you even knew you had it. It leaked out your ears or something, you know.
So, is it that the money actually buys slack, or is it the letting go of the money creates a void in your wallet that is filled with slack?
That's exact. They're sort of the yin and yang of it. It's a very good description there. You know, it's a negative balance proposition that everything has an inertial, it's like a Newton's laws, right? So, yeah, it's the giving of the money to the ministers of the church is such an exalting effect, because you know that it's going to be spent in a good and excellent way, which will definitely benefit at least the ministers. At least. You know that's going to happen. I mean, what happens when you pay your taxes? You don't know who gets it, right? You just know they're going to redistribute your wealth, and somebody's going to get it, but it won't be you. Well, it's not like that with, you know, the church. You know who's going to get it. You know? So it's all for Bob. I mean, it's not really for the ministers. The ministers are like, they're just sort of like middlemen in a transaction, which it's a slap transaction. The giving of the money as it passes through the middleman, who's really not a middleman, that's sort of a bad word. It's more like a supervisory administrative post that is like a way station, where the dollars move from a place of lesser equilibrium to a place of more equilibrium.
See, this is always one of the things I like the best about listening to the Puzzling Evidence Show, is you seem to have the science of the church. Just it sounds like an engineering problem when you discuss Slack, and I really kind of dig that.
Well, it is. It's you know, that's the good thing about, you know, everything can be, it's sort of like the quantum theory of Slack, you know, everything can be measured and ultimately broken down into smaller and smaller components, and so you just have that little quark down there, you know?
Now, actually, so that abandoned atomic super collider out in Texas, did Bob have anything to do with that?
With the abandonment? No, he won't take credit for that. He can't take credit for it. It's actually against the law for him to take credit for the abandonment of that project.
See, I'm thinking that...
Special rule that was written in a Texas bylaw.
Well, see, I'm thinking there was a strong risk that when they ran those experiments, they might actually find the nucleonic particles of slack, little tiny Dobbs heads... kind of tracing around.
I wish they, you know, actually they have a larger nuclear collider that's not is quite that big, but they've figured out ways to make them go faster now without having to use that much space. So it's interesting if you ever actually do a little investigation and read about the evolution of the, you know, particle acceleration physics and stuff. It's pretty interesting stuff. And there are, believe it or not, super colliders still being built out there. You know, you don't know about that. But that actually is part of what gets taken from you as well and gets put into like a big slush fund for scientists to play around in those areas, which is nice, I guess, if you're a scientist.
Now tell me the history of kind of how the Puzzling Evidence radio ministry came together. Because that's older than the hour of Slack, right?
Yeah, it's sort of like, there was a Subgenius radio show being broadcast on KPFA early, very, very early on in the history of the church, and from a guy named Bob Nelson, and actually was even, Doug Wellman obviously knows more than I do, but there may have even been a lady broadcaster just before Bob Nelson, but what happened was Bob decided to have some local subgeniuses on for an interview, which was Doug Wellman and Paul Mavridis, you know, Paul Mavridis and Puzzling Evidence, and Hal Robbins. I think it was Hal. It might have been Gary Gabrogefriend. I think it was Gary Gabrogefriend. Hal wasn't there yet. And so he invited these three guys on, and they pretty much sort of took over the show, you know. it became pretty much kind of like one of those yak fests that it gets to be today sometimes. Mm-hmm. And so after a while, the guests kept coming back each week. And Bob Nelson sort of like developed the show into these having these permanent guests who just sort of are like ranters who yak. And then they kind of have developed sort of a format from that. It's a real interesting format in that it takes a long time to sort of understand it. But there is several guys who will be yakking at the same time about different things, some of which agree, some of which are counter to each other, some of which are in their own areas or whatever, and then there'll be background effects and things going on at the same time, and various mixes get interwoven into it, and that's sort of the format that's evolved over time, and different players have come and gone. Puzzling Evidence, who's the mixer of the show, has been a consistent. He was one of those first guests that Bob Nelson came in, after 3 or 4 years with Bob Nelson, and the show had been going on for 3 or 4 years in a different time slot, the OK PFA, Bob actually left the show to Doug Wellman, who took over, ownership of the show, basically. And so he's pretty much the orchestrator. He runs the board and does all of the mixes, pretty much all the mixes and the selection of the music and the sound effects and things like that. And then Hal and I are like the content providers. And I don't know if you've ever been a member of a band or anything, a musical band, but for me, the best metaphor of what it feels like to be in the show is like if you're a jazz player and you play an instrument that is particularly suited for soloing. And if you've ever listened to jazz music, you've got a backbeat that holds the thing together, and then you've got these solo artists who will do a call and response, or they'll riff off of each other's riffs. And some of the old style jazz, I'm thinking like guys like Charlie Parker and Ornette Coleman and people like that who were, I just said two sax players, and why not choose that other than, I'm kind of a sax player too, but other than that, it's very much like playing in a jazz band where two guys, the solo guys will riff off of each other, and their playing will interweave, and at times it will be at odds with each other, and other times we'll feed each other, and it's really a fun thing. I'm really happy to be part of it.
Now, I'm curious, when you go into the show, do you have a group game plan, or is it really just somebody takes off on a thread and everyone kind of either follows or doesn't?
I think it's, we kind of have our own style, but we do have various, and from time to time we'll have various tools we use to help stimulate the mind while you're, but most of the time it's stream of consciousness type of riffing. You're just thinking of stuff off the top of your head. And if a theme that your partner happens to be visiting sounds interesting, it might be something that you both delve into momentarily, which might spawn a different thought, which takes you off on a tangent. And, if part of it is, I think, has to do with imagining that there's this huge radio audience out there that's listening to you, even though it's on at 3 o'clock in the morning, there's something about just hearing your own voice on the radio that has an attractive ego-feeding quality that I think that may be part of the attraction of it,
Mm-hmm.
At least to the people that are doing it. Because one of the things I like to do is later on I like to listen back to it, and I'm in a different position then. I'm in the position of the listener, and I hear different things I didn't notice when we were doing it sometimes. I hear the things that I really wanted to know was happening when we were doing it. But when you're doing it, it's kind of like you're concentrating on your playing. You don't always hear the blending of what's really going on and the nuances that you created, because that's what you were seeking. but you didn't notice them at the time, you know, and sometimes the only time you do notice them is when you're listening to it later and you go, ah, there it is, it's blending, you know. And that's kind of a neat serendipity, you know.
Mm-hmm. Well, when I listen to it, I mean, if I have moments that really crack me up, they're usually generated by you. And it usually comes down to, and some of it has to do with kind of your voice, and you've got the southern drawl and the kind of gravitas of your voice. At the same time, you're just talking the craziest boldada, and you make me think of a poker player that makes a big bet with nothing in his hand.
Yeah. I kind of like that approach, you know. That's a good analogy, you know. If you've got the package is there, then you get you get the free pass, you know. So, yeah, I agree with that. A lot of it is just how the delivery works. And, you know, I was in sales in my real life for a number of years, and it is the things that you say and the way you say it that gets the things you want accomplished, you know. If it's in a sales call or if it's in just, you know, interaction with other humans or whatever. You can say things all wrong or you can say things all right, you know. And if you say them right most of the time, you end up getting your way, you know. Because, I mean, we all wake up in the morning and we want to get our way, right? Don't you want to get your way?
Every day.
You know, every day. Where man is the grasping animal. The first thing we think of is something that we want. We want machines, you know, and we're happiest when we get what we want.
So now you said that you were in your kind of conspiracy job, you were a salesman. Now, considering that J.R. Bob Dobbs is the greatest salesman who ever lived, did that bring something to your game that you wouldn't have had without your close relationship with Bob?
Oh, yeah, I was a much better salesman after discovering Bob, you know, after getting involved in the church. Made me into a much better salesman. I was able to learn some of those arcane sales techniques from those ancient sales tomes of forgotten sales wisdom, you know. So, yeah, and I was exposed to those secrets that only initiates into the sales club get. You know, you have to carry the bag. If you haven't carried the bag, I mean, you can't really walk the walk, you know, or talk the talk. Those kind of sales analogies have to be able to sound natural, you know?
All right. Now, I want to talk a little bit. See, since you are so well acquainted with Bob, I noticed that you wrote in the Bobliographon, you wrote kind of the, I don't know, almost like a trivia section about Bob. The little known facts of Dobbs. So I found a few of these things really interesting, like the fact that Bob was selling Messerschmitt cars in 1949.
Well, you know, you go with what's selling. You go where what the people give the people what they want. Bob was always a believer in that. You know, the fact that he could get them cheap because he had connections in that part of the world—that's just good business, right?
Now, correct me if I'm wrong.
Did Prescott Bush? He had connections in that part of the world. That didn't make him a bad guy. That just made him an astute businessman.
Well, I think
he didn't know Hitler was going to go bad on him like that. You know,
didn't the late great Kurt Vonnegut do the same thing? Did they work together?
You know, I think so.
I remember,
you know,
Vonnegut talking
about
this.
Here's what I know is that hindsight prognosticators have perfect vision. It's easy to tell the future if all you're doing is telling the past. If you're looking behind you and seeing what history said and say, oh, here's what's going to happen, you know. That's pretty easy. Armchair quarterbacks do the same thing as well as backseat drivers.
Now tell us a little about the history of the Beer God and the Burger God franchises.
You mean Beer God Thirst Fucker?
Yeah, exactly.
Then it was Burger God Hunger Fucker. Well, now that was a marketing faux pas, you know, some might say. Some might say we had a bad choice there, you know, but we were really in the moment, and it was sort of like things, we thought things were headed that way. And since the investments were small and the investors were offshore, it was easy to get out of that deal, you know. But the main thing is, it was kind of an interesting idea when you hear the radio play that went with it, you know. Dear God, thirst fucker. Some people didn't like having God and fucker in the same sentence. You know, there was just something, you know, unseemly about it. So yeah, we did take some heat for that marketing campaign, but the burgers were great and the beer was really big and cold. That was the important thing, you know. The burgers, you would walk away full. It was like about the size of your head, and there was about a gallon of beer in that glass. So, you know, put two and two together. It was a good deal.
So Ray Kroc was the one who actually became rich off this formula, but you're saying compared to Bob, Kroc was a pussy.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. But he did have that whole fast food thing down, that's for sure. Give the people what they want. Now, when I wake up in the morning, one of the first things I think of is a tiny little piece of white bread with a little burnt hunk of meat in the middle of it with a pickle and a squirt of ketchup on it. That's generally, you know, what pops into my head. So they sell a million of them, you know, millions and billions and trillions of them, over 1 zillion sold.
Now, one of the things I like about the church, as I'm talking to you, I've got the bibliographon in my hand, and to the right of me, I have both of the other holy books. Now, some of those kind of lesser religions, 2,000 years ago, the holy books were written. In this church, if there's a market demand for another testament, by God, you get another testament.
Well, this is a new age religion. That's right. This is a testament, and there'll be new testaments, you know, still coming forth as necessary, at least until the Exodus arrive, you know. Some of those were foretold. If you go back in one of the early Stark Fists, it mentions some of these books that will be coming out in the next few years. And this is just simply the fulfillment of prophecy. You know, I mean, we couldn't help it, right? That's what makes it prophecy, that it comes true, and they said it would back then, you know. So, yeah, and you see that the second book, the Subgenius, the Bob Apocryphon, has been reprinted for the first time in about 10 years. And that was a big milestone. So, yeah, the church is definitely moving along.
Is the church kind of driven by the same dynamic as punk rock in that it does better in repressive times?
You know, I think one thing about it could. I imagine there could be a correlation. It might make sense, but I don't know that it's a cause and effect relationship. I think it's just an interesting thing that, you know, it's a generalization that seems like a coincidence, you know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
Generally, groups have common characteristics that are characteristic of a group, but not necessarily correlated characteristics themselves. But the group shares those characteristics, so.
I think you're doing that thing right now.
Which, the thing from the radio show?
Exactly.
Where you sound like you know what you're talking about, and people have to say, I think it sounds real, so maybe he is saying the truth.
That's the thing. So are you attending X-Day this year?
Well, I'll tell you one thing, though. You never know, because what I'm saying could be true. And it could be that I know it's true when I'm saying it, and it could be that I'm speculating in a way based on an erudite understanding of the situation and the potential variables at play. That's really the more astute trait right there.
There you go. All the best bluffs occasionally aren't really bluffs.
They're not bluffs. They're based on a very astute assessment of the situation, and and all the risks and have been weighed, and the chances considered.
Now, in the last year, I know that you had to miss X Day because you were involved in the process of creating new Yeti life on this Earth.
That's right, and we're going to miss it again this year. But next year, we're going to be there. We're going to be there with our Yeti spawn. And who knows, we'll probably have, hopefully we'll have a Yeti protector, a protectress there with us as well to nurse the baby while we're gallivanting around and cavorting with the other subgeniuses.
Now, I'm a little confused about this next year part.
Well, assuming that it doesn't come, I'm just thinking, okay, well, we may miss it, the end of the world. So we're going to have our own end of the world celebration here a week after X Day this year, just in case the world does end on X Day. You know, it takes a long time to get over on this side of the world.
Mm-hmm.
So we're thinking we have a little time to actually have a camping trip and show some movies. So we're going to do that to celebrate X Day, assuming that the world will end. And it'll be the last chance we have to get together, and so the Exodus will come and take us away and all that stuff. But just in case, you know, it doesn't happen this year, then we'll be there next year when it does happen.
Well, see, the party the week after X Day is pretty good, because wait till the 6th to order your food.
Yeah, generally, I like to party with a 5th. I like to celebrate the 4th on the 3rd with a 5th.
That sounds like a pretty good strategy. All right. Well, I guess that might be all the bull data we can take at this in one lump like this. So,
yeah, it's about almost 30 minutes.
It's almost. One question I had to ask is when you are doing the Puzzling Evidence show, are you up early on a Friday morning, or are you up late on Thursday night?
Well, that's an often hotly debated topic. There are those Thursday nighters who are constantly battling with the Friday morningers. They happen to be there at the same time, but it is definitely a perspective issue. For me, it's Friday morning, because I actually go to bed at about 8 o'clock on Thursday night, and I get up at 2, and I drive to the show, and I get there at about 3, and I'm there till 5, and then I come home, or till about 4:45. I've been taking off a little early lately because I've been working more on my conspiracy job, and so I go home and I sleep from about 5:30 to 7 or so, get a little nap in there, and then I get up and eat breakfast and go to work. And then and do, you know, the kill the rats in the gutter with the rest of the schlubs for the pittance that we get before those senators in their divinely inspired wisdom steal it out of our back pockets and beat us on the ass for not giving it to them fast enough.
Is there any coincidence in the fact that the time slot that you guys are on also corresponds perfectly with those hours of the day when most suicides occur?
I didn't know that. I really didn't know that. I hope there's not a relationship there, but, you know, if we inspire people to those things, I really, that might be something we want to check into.
See, I don't know if it correlates with that day of the week, but it is that time of day.
Yeah,
that you're the farthest off the dial.
I've never felt that. You know, it's. I tell you what, for me, when I get up that time of night and I get on the freeway and and there's no traffic and I drive through Berkeley, there's no weirdos, there's no traffic, there's no street people all over the place. It's just this interesting little town that everybody's asleep in, and so it's after doing this for several years, it's gotten to be it's kind of an interesting time that seems like it's my time. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Like a special time just for me to be on the streets and not have to ever deal with traffic or lines or congestion or just ride along. Of course, and I listen to the Over the Edge show generally on the way in, Don Joyce's show, before ours. And it's always an interesting show as well.
Yeah, I used to work rotating shifts, and there's something about that 3:30 a.m. spot that just, that's the point where life just don't really seem like worth living. So I can kind of understand that. You think that's the point.
We sort of have a ritual where they come in, Doug puts on his an intro that usually lasts for about 30 minutes, and we go wander around the studio and look at everybody's drawers and suitcases and trash cans and stuff like that, and sneak around and steal food and you know, go out on the back porch and perform powerful ejaculation activities and different, you know. And then, after we are fully relaxed and in the spirit, we go down to the show. We start the show about 3:30, and we go to 5.
Well, all right. Well, thank you very much for taking the time to kind of help me work through my own Slack issues as a fairly newly minted subgenius. It's always good to talk to the people who have the most skin in this game.
Yeah, well, keep listening to the show and tell your friends about it. And it's, you know, it's definitely a Slack ministry.
All right. Well, thank you, sir, and praise Bob.
All right. Okay, praise Bob. Yeah, yeah.
All right, my friends, there you have it. That was the interview with Philo Drummond. So multiple points in there. On the replay, I was laughing actually harder than I was at the original time. I love that. Now, I'm guessing you either loved this or you hated it, and either way is okay with me. If you want to know more about Philo Drummond, he's got a website. It's at quiveringbrain.com. The Puzzling Evidence Show is available as a podcast, and you can get there at kpfa.org/podcast. It's got a list of all their podcasts, including Puzzling Evidence. And you can learn more about the Church of the Subgenius at subgenius.com. All right, my friends. Thanks for listening, and may you have a slackful couple weeks. I'll see you again whenever the spirit of Bob moves me most. Show notes will be up at evilgeniuschronicles.org. You can send me feedback to dslusher@gmail.com. Praise Bob. I can't do the... I.